I was greatly elated with my new command, and pleased with the bright, sunshiny weather. I should, I think, have had nothing left me to desire, but for the eyes of the coxswain as they followed me derisively about the deck, and the odd smile that appeared continually on his face. The wind, serving as well, now hauled into the west. We could run so much the easier from the northeast corner of the island to the mouth of the North Inlet. Only, as we had no power to anchor, and dared not beach her till the tide had flowed a good deal farther, time hung heavy on our hands. The coxswain told me how to lay the ship to, and after a good many trials, I succeeded. Hans lay quiet for a little, and then pulled out a stick of tobacco.
"Ah, Jim, cut me a quid. It'll likely be the last, lad, for I'm for my long home and no mistake."
"Well," said I, "I'll cut you some tobacco, but if I was you, I would go to my prayers like a Christian man."
"For 30 years, he said, "I've sailed the seas, and seen good and bad, better and worse, fair weather and foul. Well, now I'll tell you, I've never seen good come out of goodness yet. Him as strikes first is my fancy. Dead men don't bite. Them's my views."
"And now look you here. The tide's made good enough by now. You just take my orders, Captain Hawkin, and we'll sail slap in and have done with it." All told, we had scarce 2 miles to run, but the navigation was delicate. The entrance to this northern anchorage was narrow and shallow, so that the schooner must be nicely handled to be got in. Scarcely had we passed the heads before the land closed around us. The shores of the North Inlet were as thickly wooded as those of the southern anchorage, but the space was longer and narrower, and more like, what in truth it was, the estuary of a river. "Now," said Hans, "look there. There's a pet bit for to beach a ship in. Fine flat sand, never a cat's paw trees all round it. And now, my boy, you stand by." So he issued his commands, which I breathlessly obeyed, till all of a sudden he cried, "Now, my hearty, luff!" And I put the helm hard up, and the Hispaniola swung round rapidly and ran stem on for the low wooded shore. The excitement of these last manoeuvres had somewhat interfered with the watch I had kept upon the coxswain. Perhaps I heard a creak, or saw his shadow moving with the tail of my eye. Perhaps it was instinct like a cat's, but sure enough, when I looked round, there was Hans already halfway towards me with a dirk in his right hand. At the same instant he threw himself forward, and I leapt sideways towards the bows. As I did so, I let go of the tiller, which sprang hard to leeward, and I think this saved my life, for it struck Hans across the chest and stopped him, for the moment, dead. Before he could recover, I was safe out of the corner where he had me trapped. Just forward of the mainmast I stopped, drew a pistol from my pocket, took cool aim and pulled the trigger. The hammer fell, but there followed neither flash nor sound. The priming was useless with seawater. One thing I saw plainly, I must not retreat before him, or he would speedily hold me boxed into the bows. Seeing that I meant to dodge, Hans paused, and a moment or two passed in feints on his part, and corresponding movements on mine. Well, while things stood thus, suddenly the Hispaniola struck, staggered, ground for an instant in the sand, and then, swift as a blow, canted over to the port side, till the deck stood at an angle of 45 degrees. We were both capsized in a second, and both of us rolled almost together into the scuppers. The sudden canting of the ship had made the deck no place for running on. Quick as a thought, I sprang into the mizzen shrouds, rattled up hand over hand, and did not draw a breath till I was seated on the cross trees. Now that I had a moment to myself, I lost no time in changing the priming of my pistols. "One more step, Mr. Hans," said I, "and I'll blow your brains out. Dead men don't bite, you know." He stopped instantly. I could see by the working of his face that he was trying to think, and the process was so slow and laborious that, in my newfound security, I laughed out loud. I was as conceited as a cock upon a wall, when, all in a breath, back went his right hand over his shoulder. Something sang like an arrow through the air. I felt a blow, and there I was, pinned by the shoulder to the mast. In the horrid pain and surprise of the moment, both my pistols went off. With a choked cry, the coxswain loosed his grasp upon the shrouds and plunged headfirst into the water. He rose once to the surface in a lather of foam and blood, and then sank again, for good. I began to feel sick, faint, and terrified. Hot blood was running over my back and chest. My first thought was to pluck out the dirk, but either it stuck too hard or my nerve failed me. and I desisted with a violent shudder. Oddly enough, the knife had come nearest in the world to missing me altogether. It held me by a mere pinch of skin, and this the shudder tore away. I then regained the deck by the starboard shrouds and went below to do what I could for my wound. Then I looked around me. I was now alone upon the Hispaniola. The tide had just turned. The evening breeze had sprung up, and the idle sails had begun to rattle to and fro. I began to see danger to the ship. The jibs I speedily doused and brought tumbling to the deck, but the mainsail was a harder matter. I got my knife and cut the halyards. The peak dropped instantly. A great belly of loose canvas floated broad upon the water. That was the extent of what I could accomplish. For the rest, the Hispaniola must trust to luck, like myself.
I scrambled forward and looked over. The water seemed shallow enough, and holding the cut hawser in both hands for a last security, I let myself drop softly overboard. At least, and at last, I was off the sea. Nor had I returned thence empty-handed. There lay the schooner, clear at last from the buccaneers and ready for our own men to board and get to sea again. So thinking, and in famous spirits, I began to set my face homeward for the blockhouse and my companions. Gradually the night fell blacker. It was all I could do to guide myself even roughly towards my destination. Then suddenly a kind of brightness fell about me. I looked up. A pale glimmer of moonbeams had alighted on the summit of Spyglass Hill. With this to help me, I passed rapidly over what remained to me of my journey, and sometimes walking, sometimes running, impatiently drew near to the stockade. The moon was climbing higher and higher, and right in front of me a glow of a different colour appeared among the trees. It was red and hot, and now and again it was a little darkened, as it were the embers of a bonfire smouldering. I stopped with much wonder in my heart, and perhaps a little terror also. It had not been our way to build great fires, and I began to fear that something had gone wrong in my absence. I stole round by the eastern end, keeping close in shadow, and at a convenient place where the darkness was thickest, crossed the palisade. There was no doubt of one thing. My companions kept an infamous bad watch. If it had been Silver and his lads creeping in on them, not a soul would have seen daybreak. By this time I had got to the door and stood up. All was dark within, so that I could distinguish nothing by the eye. With my arms before me, I walked steadily in. I should lie down in my own place, I thought with a silent chuckle, and enjoy their faces when they found me in the morning. And then, all of a sudden, a shrill voice broke forth out of the darkness.
Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight!
Silver's Green Parrot. Captain Flint. I had no time left me to recover. At the sharp, clipping tone of the parrot, the sleepers awoke and sprang up, and with a mighty oath the voice of Silver cried, "Who goes?" I turned to run, struck violently against one person, recoiled, and ran straight into the arms of a second, who, for his part, closed upon and held me tight. "Bring a torch stick," said Silver, when my capture was thus assured. The red glare of the torch, lighting up the interior of the blockhouse, showed me the worst of my apprehensions realized. The pirates were in possession of the house and stores, and what tenfold increased my terror, not a sign of any prisoner. The parrot sat, preening her plumage, on Long John's shoulder.
"So," said he, "here's Jim Hawkins, shiver me timbers, dropped in like, eh? Oh, come, I take that friendly."
To this I made no answer. They had set me with my back against the wall, and I stood there, looking Silver in the face, pluckily enough, I hope, to all outward appearances, but with black despair in my heart.
"Now, you see, Jim, so be as you are here," says Silver, "I'll give you a piece of my mind. I always wanted you to join and take your share and die as a gentleman. I never seen good come out of threatening. If you like the service, you'll join. And if you don't, Jim, why, you're free to say no. Free and welcome, shipmate."
"Well," say I, "if I'm to choose, I declare I have a right to know what's what, and why you're here, and where my friends are."
"All right," said he.
Yesterday morning, in the dog watch, down came Dr. Livesey with a flag of truce. We bargained, him and I, and here we are. Stores, brandy, and the blockhouse. As for them, they've tramped. I don't know where's they are.
Is that all?
I asked.
Well, it's all you're to hear, my son, returned Silver.
By this time, I was quite excited, and I told them, defiantly, all that I had done, and that they would never more see the Hispaniola. To my wonder, not a man of them moved, but all sat staring at me, like as many sheep.
Well, and see here, said Silver, first and last, we've split upon Jim Hawkins. Then here goes, said an old mahogany-faced seaman, Morgan by name, and he sprang up, drawing his knife as if he had been 20. Avast there, cried Silver. Who are you, Tom Morgan? Maybe you thought you was captain here, perhaps. By the powers, but I'll teach you better. Cross me and you go where many a good man's gone before you. I like that boy. Let me see him that'll lay a hand on him. That's what I say, and you may lay to it.
There was a long pause after this. Silver leant back against the wall, his arms crossed, as calm as though he had been in church. Yet his eye kept wandering furtively, and he kept the tail of it on his unruly followers. They, on their part, drew gradually together towards the far end of the blockhouse, and the low hiss of their whispering sounded in my ear continuously, like a stream.
You seem to have a lot to say, remarked Silver. Pipe up, and let me hear it, or lay to.
I ax your pardon, sir, acknowledging you for to be captain at this present, said one, an ill-looking yellow-eyed man, but I claim my right, and steps outside for a council.
And so, with one remark or another, all marched out, and left Silver and me alone with the torch.
Now look you here, Jim Hawkins, said Silver in a steady whisper that was no more than audible. They're going to throw me off. But you, Mark, I stand by you through thick and thin. I didn't mean to. No, not till you spoke up. But I see you was the right sort. I says to myself, you stand by Hawkins, John, and Hawkins will stand by you. Back to back, says I. You save your witness, and he'll save your neck.
I began dimly to understand. You mean all's lost? I asked.
Aye, by gum, I do, he answered. Once I looked into that bay, Jim Hawkins, and seen no schooner, I gave out. I'll save your life from them. But see here, Jim, tit for tat, you save Long John from swinging.
What I can do, that I'll do, I said.
It's a bargain, cried Long John. You speak up, Plucky, and by thunder I've a chance.
He drew some cognac from the cask into a tin canikin.
I need a corker, he said, for there's trouble on hand. And talking of trouble, why did that doctor give me the chart, Jim?
My face expressed a wonder so unaffected that he saw the needlessness of further questions.
Oh, well, he did, though, said he. And there's something under that, no doubt, something surely under that, Jim, bad or good.
And he took another swallow of the brandy, shaking his great fair head like a man who looks forward to the worst.